Hey everyone, this is Jonathan Capehart. Welcome to Cape Up. This week's episode comes to you from the West Wing of the White House and the office of Susan Rice. The National Security Advisor to President Obama and I covered a lot of ground. Syria, Russia, Benghazi, race, the talk, how she met her husband, and whether she's played basketball with the president. We had just 20 minutes with Ambassador Rice, but you can hear it all right now. Ambassador Rice, thanks so much for being on Cape Up.
It's good to be with you, Jonathan.
So there's this tradition of the outgoing president leaving a letter for his successor. Does something like that happen between national security advisors?
No, because if the transition is working as it should be, I will have had the opportunity to spend hours sitting down, probably at this very table, with my successor. I will have shared reams of paper and briefing materials. And had the opportunity to go through in depth my best assessment of what would be most helpful for my successor to have at his fingertips.
Mm-hmm. And what are the three things that will occupy the incoming National Security Advisor's time? And broadly speaking.
Three things. Why do you think there are only three?
Well, I'm just trying to limit it. We don't have that much time.
I wish I had the luxury of only three things occupying my time.
Well, the three, like top of my, North Korea, Russia, China, Syria,
all
ISIS.
All of the above.
All of the, there's not one.
The challenge in this job, Jonathan, and the challenge in national security policymaking in the current context is we have to walk and chew gum at the same time. We've got multiple opportunities out there and multiple challenges. And any national security advisor worth his or her salt has to be able to manage and lead on those myriad of issues simultaneously. So obviously there's some particularly pressing things. The most sacred responsibility that anybody in my office has is doing their utmost to keep the American people safe. So the counterterrorism mission, the homeland security mission, the counter-ISIL and counter-Al-Qaeda missions are critical. But that's by no means sufficient because we do live in a world in which we have challenges that emanate from Russia, from North Korea, from the larger instability in the Middle East, in particular in Syria and Iraq. And we have concerns in places like South Sudan, where there's a risk of mass atrocities. We have interests in all of Asia, to which we have rebalanced and focused a great deal of economic security and diplomatic attention. We care about what happens in our own hemisphere. So we have to do many different things simultaneously and keep our eye on all of these things and devise effective policies to the greatest extent possible across a range of challenges.
Wow. I mean, you basically walked us around the globe in that answer. I want to just zero in on a couple of those. I mean, you mentioned China and you mentioned Russia. Should the American people be concerned about the Russians, given what we've seen just in the last few months?
Well, Russia has been and remains a serious challenge across a number of dimensions. It's a country with which we have worked cooperatively on a number of issues. For example, the Iran nuclear deal, nuclear stockpile reductions, even on global issues, like many of the issues that I used to work with on a daily basis in the UN are issues on which we have managed to cooperate with Russia and need to cooperate with Russia. On the other hand, they are a formidable military power with, I think, still growing and nationalist ambitions. They have annexed illegally Crimea from the Ukraine and still threaten eastern Ukraine. And they're behaving in an absolutely horrific and unconscionable way in Syria with their relentless bombing campaign to back up a dictator. So we have very profound differences with Russia and very good reasons to be concerned about Russian behavior and Russian intentions. On the other hand, Russia is sufficiently important and instrumental in dealing with a range of global and regional challenges that we don't have the luxury of ignoring it. Mm-hmm. And where we can, we have to try to work with it. So it's a difficult balancing act.
You mentioned working with Russia in Syria, and you were the Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs under President Clinton. The Rwandan genocide happened then. Today, President Obama is facing a similar similarly horrifying situation with what's happening to the Syrian people under Bashar al-Assad. From where you sit, what are the similarities and differences in the response, the presidential response, and the circumstances surrounding them?
Well, they're very different circumstances, Jonathan, both horrific. The Rwandan genocide lasted a mere 100 days, and up to a million people were killed hand-to-hand, house-to-house with machetes in a very organized and systematic fashion. And it was a crisis that outpaced the will and the capacity of the countries in the region and the larger international community to respond effectively. Syria is quite a different situation. This is a civil war that has morphed into a regional conflict and to some extent a proxy war between the Assad regime and its adversaries. Those that have died have not died through a systematic genocide, but rather through horrific violence perpetrated primarily by the government and its backers, but also by the opposition. And to complicate things further in Syria, we have the establishment of the of ISIL, as we call it, the Islamic State in the Iraq and the Levant, and we have al-Qaeda present. And these are two very proximate adversaries for the United States and our allies in the coalition, because they pose a direct threat to Europe, to the United States, and to various others. So we have intervened in Iraq and Syria, in Iraq with the invitation of the government, in Syria out of necessity, to deal with the ISIL threat and the al-Qaeda threat to the United States and our allies. We have not intervened in the civil war, except through our support to opposition partners and forces, our humanitarian assistance, which totals well over $5 billion and makes us the largest donor to the humanitarian crisis.
That was $5 billion.
Billion with a B, yes. And this has lasted over 5 years, and we have multiple challenges and multiple interests. Our primary interest is dealing with the terrorist threat and eliminating it before it can do grave damage or further damage to our allies and partners or to Americans themselves. We also have a deep and abiding humanitarian interest, and that's why we have tried to invest in providing relief to the people of Syria, to the refugees and the displaced, to the neighboring countries who are harboring millions of refugees. But it's also why we've invested so much diplomatic energy in trying to broker a lasting end to the violence, humanitarian access, and ultimately a negotiated diplomatic solution. We've worked tirelessly with the Russians and many other partners to try to accomplish that. Unfortunately, thus far, to little avail. So it's a very different set of circumstances, both horrific, but the latter in Syria, we believe, is potentially amenable to a diplomatic solution. We've worked very, very hard to achieve that. And in our estimation, the blame for its failure rests substantially with the regime in Syria and its backers in Russia and Iran.
Mm-hmm. I don't want to relitigate the past, but I have to ask you about September 16th, 2012. That was when you were on the Sunday shows. It was just after the attack on Benghazi happened. Is there anything, if you could go back in time, is there anything you would have done differently?
Well, first of all, Jonathan, as I've said in many contexts and on many occasions, I was asked by the White House when I was then the ambassador to the United Nations if I would appear on the Sunday shows and represent the administration, as I'd done many times in the past and done many times subsequently. The news of the week, as people tend to forget now, was not only Benghazi, it was the attacks around the world on our diplomatic facilities, from Africa to Afghanistan to parts of Asia. And that was a substantial part of the context. And so was the fact that in the coming days, the UN General Assembly, the annual gathering of heads of state, was about to occur. So I was on these shows talking about the attacks on the embassies, Benghazi, Iran, and Prime Minister Netanyahu's upcoming visit to the United States. I was asked about Benghazi, and I gave, as I said at the time, the best information that the U.S. intelligence community had at the time. I said that it was liable to change, that this was our best current assessment. And I guess if I have any regret, I might, in retrospect, have taken my mother's advice and not gone on the Sunday shows.
Right. And I have here for my own reference, because it's been released, those talking points. And if only people had paid attention to what you actually said, maybe a lot of the stuff that you had to go through wouldn't have happened.
Well, I don't know if it was that they didn't pay attention or they chose not to hear what I said, because and this is something we can discuss and debate at length. But I think, as you know, I have answered these questions lots of times, including, frankly, in front of the so-called Benghazi committee of Congress.
Which one?
The last one.
Okay.
Which one of the seven? Yes,
right.
Exactly. The one that took the longest and went out with a whimper rather
right.
than a bang. But, you know, the fact of the matter is, and all of the investigations have validated this, that these were the intelligence community's produced points. They were their best understanding of what had happened at the time. I was careful to say that this was preliminary and could change. And indeed, some days after I went on the Sunday shows, their assessment did change. But at the time, that was what we could say. And sometimes people have asked, well, why didn't I insert my own opinion or judgment into what had happened? And my answer to that is that would have been completely inappropriate for me to make up my own judgment and share it on the fly if it was in contravention of what our experts had at that point determined.
One of the reasons why I wanted to bring this up was, one, not only to ask you about that particular moment in time, but also the reaction I remember from the Congressional Black Caucus was to send a letter to their colleagues arguing that the treatment of you by those senators was raising the question whether race played a factor. They were mostly white men, and as we pointed out on the editorial page, they were mostly from states in the Confederacy. Do you think race played a role in what turned out to be their ultimate objective, and that was to keep President Obama from naming you as Secretary of State?
Well, Jonathan, I'm not sure that was their primary objective when this started. Remember, we were in the middle of an election campaign, and I think whatever the motivations, and to the extent that they were political, I don't think they related to me in the first instance. So let's put it that way. Secondly, to be candid, I don't attribute this to race. I attribute it to partisan politics. You know, this could have happened in much the same way if I were a white male. And I think for some of my colleagues who also felt they were unfairly treated in the context of Benghazi, most of them were white males. So I don't think that's the principal variable, although I must say I was grateful for the support not only of the Congressional Black Caucus, but many, many, many members of Congress in both houses.
Our late friend Gwen Ifill said in a speech once, "It is important to be reminded how easily we can be denied simple, obvious opportunity, how low the ceilings can get, and how much fortitude it takes to refuse to accept the limits that others place on you." And like Gwen, you're an African-American woman who occupies rarefied air. How much fortitude does it take for you to refuse to accept the limits that others place on you?
That's a great question, and I can't help but take a minute just to say how much I miss Gwen. What an incredible human being and journalist and just friend. Leaving that aside just for a second to try to answer your question, I mean, I feel very, very fortunate that as a child of the 1960s, born in 1964, two African-American parents here in Washington, D.C. My father served in the segregated army in World War II at Tuskegee.
Yeah, he was a Tuskegee Airman, right?
Yes, he was. My mom grew up in Maine, but also in a period of segregation, even though that wasn't her direct experience. I was raised by these parents to believe that I could do whatever I set out to do, and that there weren't limits except those of my own abilities. And that was an incredible gift they gave me and gave me, I think, early in the window in which any parent could credibly pass on such lessons to a child in our country. And I benefited enormously from parents who believed in me, who challenged me, encouraged me, and literally raised me to believe that I didn't face limits. And I've been bold enough to believe that ever since.
I'm looking over your shoulder. There are pictures of your family. And I'm looking at the picture of your son. And I'm wondering, given the conversations that this nation has been through over the last couple of years in terms of the talk, have you had the talk with your son?
The talk about race and being a black man in America, or which talk
That's
are we
exactly
talking
about? That's exactly the talk. No, well, yes, exactly that talk.
Yes. But I think Jonathan is, you will see from the photographs behind you, my children are interracial. My husband is white. And my children, my daughter in particular, in many contexts, be mistaken as other than African-American or even mixed. My son looks like he could be anything from African-American to Hispanic to Jewish to Arab. And so he's kind of hard to put in any particular box by just looking at him. But of course, I've had that discussion with my son. He's a teenage boy. And although he's lived a relatively sheltered life, he's, you know, he's a man in this world. And I think any child, frankly, black or white, male or female, needs to understand that we live in a context in which they have to be careful and mindful of how they treat other people, how people perceive them, and that in many contexts, particularly for a black boy, intentions and responses to intentions can be grossly misinterpreted and dangerously so on occasion.
Now, you mentioned your husband, Ian. How'd you guys meet?
We met in college. We lived in the same dormitory at Stanford University. And I was a freshman and he was a senior. And he would say that he had the foresight to find me before it was popular. But we met when I was young. I was 17, almost just about to turn 18.
And so he approached you or you approached him?
He approached me.
And had you seen him before?
Well, so you really want to go there.
Well, I mean, this of course. Was, why ask this, the question if I'm not going to get
this?
The...
So we lived in the same dormitory. As I said, I was a freshman. We met within the first week of my freshman year. And we met at one of these early events where the upperclassmen in the dormitory threw a sort of social event. I think it was an ice cream social, to be particular, for the freshmen. So I was, you know, fresh out of Washington, D.C., moving to California. I'd come from an all-girls school. Here I am in a co-ed environment, and I'm free. So I wasn't looking to you know, go out with the first guy I met. And indeed, I didn't. But he approached me at this ice cream social, and we started talking, had a great conversation. He asked me out a few times, and after a respectable period of enjoying my freedom, I decided to start going out with him.
Mm-hmm. So in college, you played sports?
No, I played sports in high school.
In high school, but you played basketball?
I played basketball in high school and tennis. I hacked around in college, but didn't play any varsity sports at Stanford. My skills would never allow that.
Okay, so my next question means nothing. You've never played basketball with the president.
These are two different issues, whether I played at college or played with basketball with the president.
So
but no, I am smart enough not to play basketball with the president.
last question, because you are a busy person, and there's a buzz of activity around here in your office. Your favorite leader over the last 8 years?
Foreign leader? What do you mean?
Foreign leader. Yes, foreign leader.
Not including the President of the United States?
Well, yes. No, that's what I mean.
He would be my favorite.
Of
but
course.
If you're looking for a less obvious answer, seriously?
Yeah, I'm serious.
That's interesting. Probably Angela Merkel.
I knew it. I knew you were going to say Merkel.
You know why?
Why?
She's just so down to earth and real. She's smart. She's direct. She doesn't beat around the bush. She's unpretentious. And she's a good human being. And she's been a phenomenal head of state. And it's really nice to see a woman play the sort of strong leadership role that she has. But I think they're, you know, she'd be the number one, mm-hmm. and certainly number one of sitting leaders as we speak today, mm-hmm. other than, of course, my boss.
Right.
There are others. Give me another one. I mean, I admire Justin Trudeau.
Mm-hmm. Canadian Prime Minister.
Obviously, yeah, Canadian Prime Minister. Not nearly as experienced but fresh and very nice person, good heart. I think a very progressive vision for Canada, a country that I have a lot of affection for. Mm-hmm. I think he's restored Canada's position on the global stage to being the progressive principled leader that his father and his father's successors enabled Canada to become, and I think sadly for some period wasn't. So I find him interesting and exciting. And there, if I had more time, I'd scour the planet and give you a few others. But
I'll let you off the hook and not ask you, who you've done shots with and hung out at the bar with. Because I know it's happened. Come on.
No comment.
And on that note, Ambassador Susan Rice, National Security Advisor to President Obama, thank you so much.
Thank you, Jonathan. It was fun.
Thanks for listening to Cape Up. Tune in every Tuesday. You can find us on iTunes and Stitcher. You know what? Do me a favor. Subscribe and then rate and review us. I'm Jonathan Capehart of The Washington Post. You can find me on Twitter @CapehartJ.